Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we look at the mental health therapy EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. Joining us, social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning.
Hi there.
And Autumn Pryor, who's a certified EMDR therapist. Hi, Autumn.
Morning.
So before we get to what EMDR is and how it works, let's talk a little bit about trauma. How do we define that? What does trauma mean?
So from my perspective and my training, we qualify it as anything that hasn't been processed completely at this point. It's memory networks, things that have happened that haven't been completely processed and still live in our nervous systems today, that still have the emotion that you felt at the time that you had it, that contributed to negative beliefs that you may have about yourself. And so that can look like a number of things. It can be small traumas that people may not necessarily acknowledge, that they don't even realize have compacted them and impacted them in ways in terms of how they view themselves. But also, you know, the bigger traumas that people can more easily identify, such as car accidents, war, combat, things like that.
Yeah. It's interesting when you say it still lives in our nervous system, because we've talked about this before. You start talking about some traumatic, and you can feel it. Your body doesn't forget it, right? Whether you acknowledge it or not, your body remembers it.
When you talk to patients who have traumatic memories, sometimes they'll be talking about something from 20 years ago and they'll like smell toast, or they'll, you know, somehow they can report those memories with such clarity that, you know, oh, this one is still present for them.
Yeah. There's been so much recent research on how trauma impacts our health, even years later, you know, that, and I don't think it's something we really thought much about in the past, right? But it really can have lifelong impacts on our health.
Yes.
Absolutely. It's associated with bad health, essentially. Meaning like cancer is one thing, heart disease, the big killers that we know. It wears down the nervous system with inflammation, probably is the main way it happens. The common denominator in trauma experiences that cause these kind of problems, and as Autumn said about not being processed, is a sense of helplessness. It can be temporary or it can be long lasting, but just a sense of helplessness and lack of safety. A big threat without any particular way out, and you're trapped. That's immediate sense of helplessness and or long term is a major trauma. And when that happens, the brain can't handle it. The brain just is overwhelmed, essentially, you're quote unquote scared to death, and that's the kind of experience that it has. So it happens in very common in combat, we can talk about it in other places, especially in the family. It happens. Mm-hmm. So, but basically, it's the brain being overwhelmed with making sense, and also having in some ways it's a near death experience of the psyche, at least. That, you know, we've evolved to survive, when you come close to not surviving, that's different than remembering what you had for breakfast. It takes front and center, and just overwhelms the person's ability to cope with it.
Yeah. Jonathan, want to add anything to what's being said?
No, I'm eager to hear what Jenny and Autumn, have to report to us
They
because
have both
they're both
certified in EMDR, right?
quite experts in this
But
area.
yeah, before we get on to that, though, let me ask you this. A traumatic event can impact people differently. And I'm wondering why. I'm thinking like two children who grew up in the same household where there's a lot of trauma. One of them can be really impacted greatly by that, and another not so much. Why?
Well, I would argue that a family that has a lot of trauma, all of the people are impacted, but impacted differently, that they have different coping mechanisms. So you often, I was just hanging out with a friend of mine who was one of five girls. She's the middle and single mother raising them who, you know, not always like she's the mother said, oh, I told the oldest girl some lessons in life and just assumed those would be passed down to the kids. So that sort of gives you an idea of the sort of benign neglect, if nothing else. And so four of the girls are pretty impacted in terms of how their lives have not quite come together. And my friend is like a super caretaker. Like she cannot not be taking care of someone in any moment. So to look at her, you might say she wasn't impacted. She was definitely impacted. So she, her nervous system is on full go 24/7. And so I think very much about the nervous system and the polyvagal nervous system in particular, in terms of how we think about trauma. So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, Autumn, because I haven't, it's been a while since I've actually studied it, but my understanding is that parts of the brain turn off during a traumatic event and other parts stay on. And so depending on the person, different parts might turn on and stay off, stay on and turn off. Autumn, you were going to say.
I actually use a metaphor with my clients that when you have a house and you have the hairdryer on and you have a vacuum cleaner on and the microwave on, what happens? It blows a fuse and some sockets work.
All right, well, guess what? We're having a little trouble with Autumn's audio. Dan, maybe you want to get Autumn on the phone because she's kind of coming in and out. So while we do that, while we get Autumn in a better connection, so Jenny, so when you're saying everybody's impacted, it is more of it's like a range, right? So some people could feel it more than others and others less so, and it all has to do with how it's impacted your nervous system and your coping skills. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. So in The Body Keeps the Score, there's a famous story where a friend of Basil van der Kolk's, this couple was in a big, huge car accident in Canada, biggest car accident in Canada. And the husband, whenever he thought about it, he was very like anxious and wanted to be fight flight. He was ready to go. It was very hard for him to sit still. Whereas the wife sort of just turned off. And when they did brain scans, so what they had done was they had people write out the trauma and then read it out while they are having their brain scanned. So when he read it, certain parts had turned off. And so all of his resources were on flight or flight, whereas her brain just kind of turned all off. So that we call that collapse or freeze. So if you think of the deer in the headlights. So those are just very different. And it does depend on your internal resources, your kind of nature, how, you know, your DNA, how you are created, and also nurture. So that combination of things, just like with any disease or anything, is going to look different for everybody. There's always going to be a spectrum of how our nervous systems and our bodies work because they're so complex.
Those factors that you just listed add up to resiliency. And everybody is different in being very resilient or not so resilient in terms of what happens to them.
Right, so, another spectrum, right? Yeah. You can look at it in terms of resilience. So I think that we always try to look at, and in EMDR as well, what are your strengths? How can we build on your strengths so that when we go into reprocessing the traumatic event, We've sort of shored up those strengths. Would you agree with that, Autumn?
We want the access to the adaptive information there. And when people have gone through traumas, depending on what their experience has been, some people have more access to adaptive information than others. So part of the work is, like Jenny was saying, it's strengthening that to which people may not be accessing as far as what's positive and can help process the negative material.
All right, so EMDR people are going, EMDR, what is that? So Autumn, what is it?
So as you said earlier, it's eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And what it does is it capitalizes on your brain's natural tendency to heal itself. It's already things your brain's doing when it's processing information. But we take advantage of it when the brain gets stuck and it's not able to process traumas in real time. So basically, what you're doing is you're bringing into mind the traumatic event or the whatever's still living in your nervous system. And we typically use eye movements. Eye movements is the gold standard as far as bilateral stimulation, but there's all different kinds. There's tactile and as well as things you can do for hearing. But you're bringing to mind in an organized way that's tolerable to the client, the memory, and you're coupling it with these eye movements that help reprocess because it's we need to reprocess. It hasn't been processed all the way through. And so that your brain can then make sense of it and put it back into long-term memory where it belongs. And having lost its charge, having lost the emotional piece that's going with it that still lives in your nervous system. Things will still be sad. Things will still be, we'll still look back on memories and say, yeah, that wasn't great. But it doesn't have to disturb us in our bodies. And that's the important part.
Right. You
The eye movement part, just to explain it a little bit more, you're basically moving your eyes from the left to the right ra fairly rapidly. When in training, sometimes it's the therapist's finger that moves right and left. There's light bars that are used. And then there's sound headphones that are used where there's a beep in one ear, then a beep in another ear. And basically, what it's doing is it's stimulating sequentially each side of the brain fairly rapidly. And that's distracting in terms of processing some information. And it over time and over repeated sessions, this is what detoxifies the emotion of it. It brings it, you see, we usually have mechanisms in our brain. Well, we do. We have this thing called the hippocampus, which is the first way station where experiences first process means going through. That part of the brain puts a timestamp on what happens. Whereas with trauma, the hippocampus isn't working. The information bypasses in an acute trauma, it bypasses the hippocampus, and it goes into is processed mainly by the amygdala, which is the fear center. You have offline the hippocampus, and you have offline the thinking part of the brain, the conscious thinking part of the brain, where logical reasoning comes from. So those two parts are kind of offline, and what results is different than a memory. It's an experience that is devoid of a timestamp. It doesn't feel like it's in the past. It feels like it's present, and there's no logic activity, logic perspective to it. So that's what you have in the brain, and because of these parts of the brain that have been o essentially overwhelmed or bypassed by the experience of the trauma. You have a unique experience that's recorded as opposed to a memory that's recorded. Because a memory would have those things like logic and a timestamp as to when it happened.
Right. Autumn, you mentioned what's tolerable to the patient. I'm just thinking there may be people go, you know what, I don't want to go down that. I don't want to remember this. I don't want to, you know, go there. So how does, when you have a situation like that, you know, how do you deal with that when it's like, I can't go there?
So that is one of the most beautiful things about EMDR therapy, I find, is that people do not have to do the talk therapy and go into the gory details of things. In fact, I've had many clients along the way where they just tell me enough so that I know things are moving and things are processing. And other therapy that requires more verbalization of things that are very painful. And so with EMDR, it is not imperative for people to go into all the gruesome details. What I do find is after they've reprocessed, people want to talk about the details because they find they can, and it's very empowering for them. So EMDR is not like other therapies where you don't need to go there in terms of that. The other thing is there's other ways to help a client process the memory. We can take it in smaller pieces, you know, and adapt it to what clients need. We don't do as many eye movements maybe in a segment so that we're not, you know, having all of the stuff come up all at once. There are so many tricks that we can use to help make it more palpable for people so that things get reprocessed in a way that in therapy is not traumatic. Mm-hmm. So that's another big piece. And that's why, you know, training, you know, working with a trained therapist who understands all these mechanisms is really important to, you know, be able to work with somebody so that they are cared for and supported during the process.
And that's part of the protocol of the EMDR, that you make sure that the person can kind of establish mentally what they call a safe place. Mm-hmm. So before you get into any trauma at all, you have them do the eye movements while they relax, while they deep breathe, and imagine a calm, safe place that is relevant to them. They already have that gives them the association of this process is calming. Right. And if you get upset, which people frequently do, you can always stop the process of, you know, dealing with the trauma, and go back to just the relaxation part of it.
Right.
The other thing that one of the most beautiful things to me about the work was always when, say you're processing the death of someone, is suddenly people have been so fixated on that moment or those weeks, let's say it was a protracted illness or something of illness, that they've sort of lost access to the good memories. And so as you start to process, they'll say, oh, I remember this moment, maybe in the hospital, that was very calming and sweet and about attachment. Or they start to remember the relationship they had prior to the illness, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or a child, you know, I did a lot of medical trauma. And so like a child who was very terrified in a hospital, and then they would say, oh, but now I'm remembering my mother or father there trying to comfort me. And so that's really back to the adaptive things, is that the adaptive memories come back. The brain is just so incredible, and its ability to heal itself.
Yeah.
It's really about the therapist definitely having some of those tricks to help people calm down or slow down, but really mostly the therapist is just trying to get out of the way and help the person get out of their own way and let the brain heal itself.
Which your brain does on a regular basis. And I tell people, you know, your brain does this every night. When you're sleeping and you go into deep REM sleep, you are doing eye movements under those eyelids. And people can often understand that when, you know, if something happened that day or they had a bad day at work and they go to bed at night, they wake up the next morning and it doesn't feel so bad and they can look back and it feels further away. That is exactly what we're doing during EMDR therapy. We're just using it to our advantage. Mm,
that's why they say sleep on it, right?
Before you...
Yes. All right, we're talking about the mental health therapy, EMDR. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the mental health therapy EMDR with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and Autumn Pryor, who's a certified EMDR therapist. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we've been talking about trauma, and we often hear about EMDR being used to treat trauma like PTSD. But what are some of the other disorders, Autumn, that this can be used for? Certainly helpful in trauma, right? But what else?
So I've used it to treat things like depression and generalized anxiety, working on things like poor self-esteem. It can be used to treat addiction. There's different protocols that can be used to treat addiction. One of the things that, so EMDR in the standard protocol, it looks at three things. It looks at memory networks from three perspectives. How is it living in the body? It's looking at the emotions that go with it and your belief system as a result. So if you look at any one of those disorders, depression, for example, all of that can be created by a belief system about someone, as how they view themselves as a memory network of things that they've been through to create this feeling of hopelessness or helplessness or feeling that they're incapable or they're defective. And so when EMDR addresses these different disorders, we look at memory networks that lead up to these are the symptoms that happen because of the way we make sense of them regarding ourselves, but the emotions we feel and what's living in our body system.
So I'm just thinking anxiety, of course, a lot of people have anxiety. And sometimes we confuse anxiety with depression. And I'm wondering how this works with anxiety. Mark mentioned earlier that sometimes that logical thinking part of the brain isn't working. But I'm thinking when you have a lot of people with anxiety, they kind of realize, you know, intellectually, I'm afraid to go over the bridge. Why would I be afraid to go over the bridge? It doesn't make sense. Yet they're feeling it in their body. They're feeling it. So how does this work with anxiety?
So if I had a client who presented with this exact scenario, I would be looking about past networks that are contributing to this current feeling of either helplessness or that they can't do it. That makes them feel, you know, these underlying things that they're saying to themselves. So typically, you know, if I had a client, it's not just about the bridge. It's not just about going over the bridge and that's, you know, what they're having problems with. It's other things that have happened to them along the way in their life that they've made sense of in a way about their capabilities or their being in danger when they're really not, because they've been through other pieces of things that have now led to this. And part of EMDR is looking at those past present connections and how things are surfacing now as a result. The idea then is to go back into the past, resolve, desensitize and reprocess those earlier memories that created either that sense of not being safe or that sense of defectiveness, or that sense of vulnerability, powerlessness, or lack of control, resolving that so that therefore that now in the present, that when they're confronted with situations, that they're not bringing all of that stuff from the past. Mm.
Jenny, you want to add anything to that?
I'm just thinking, so Autumn has mentioned all these sort of, we think of them as, I'm forgetting the word, but these places we get stuck, mm-hmm. defectiveness, safety. And I know that her mentor is Dini Laliotis. And I was wondering, because they, a while ago, were talking also about not belonging as another area. And that can be sort of defectiveness, but it can also just be this fear of not being part of your tribe. And so going over the bridge could mean fear of the bridge collapsing, but it could also mean moving away from your tribe and sort of this fear that if you move away, you might become disconnected from them. And so, and all of that sounds very esoteric, but it becomes very real in the moment with the patients as you sort of question them and find out what their core beliefs are. And suddenly there's this moment where they're like, oh, And then you know what to process. And so when she's talking about memory networks, if you think about like a tree, there might be an early memory of, you know, there might be something as early as crying in the crib and your mother is busy or your father's busy so they can't come. And then later there's a memory of being in college and or in high school and being rejected, or then maybe in at work you had a, you know, so those are all connected networks leading to this idea that maybe you don't belong.
And you wouldn't really,
or that you're unsafe. I mean, you could think of those in all different ways, depending on what, where you're stuck.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, Jenny, as you mentioned, that like you obviously would have no memory of crying in your crib, right? And how would you, as a, you know, just a regular, how would you make those connections, right? So that, I guess, part of the job as a therapist is to help find those connections, right?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that sometimes it's not often that. At least me, maybe Autumn, you've done this, but it's not often that we go all the way back to that early of a memory. But what happens sometimes is that somebody has a body feeling, a feeling in their body. And so then you focus on that instead of on the memory. So when you start EMDR, you activate the memory, the specific memory, what thoughts are coming up associated with the memory, but also what sensations are in the body. And so you can just focus on one of those things. Emotions also, that's another one, but you can just focus on one of them if nothing else is coming up.
I just want to get back to a question that you asked earlier, Mindy, about why is it that some people might, you know, several siblings growing up in the same household might respond very differently to what appears to be a singular kind of traumatic environment. There's this whole relatively new field known as epigenetics, which I have had a great deal of difficulty understanding, but it is truly a field that's in its infancy. But essentially what epigenetics tells us, and for which there's a great deal of evidence, is that the expression of people's DNA actually can be altered and is altered by circumstances in our lives. So that, I mean, it's just kind of hard to really wrap your head around that your DNA is not just your DNA, because different parts of your DNA can be opened or closed, can be expressed differently. That and not to say that every sibling has exactly the same DNA to begin with. Of course, that's not the case. Five siblings growing up in the same house have a lot of DNA in common, but they also have some differences. Mm-hmm. But the epigenetics can also color or significantly influence what happens to us down the road. Even an acute illness that creates a physiological stress on our body may have an impact on what chromosomes are expressed down the road. So I don't know if you know, Jenny or Autumn have some thoughts about that, but that's a whole other layer of why we turn out differently from those who are beside us.
Yeah. Autumn, you're nodding your head.
So there's definitely been studies that trauma does change your genetics over, and they find generational trauma that as down the line that it changes your genetics, it changes your cellular formulations, like it changes information in the mitochondria of cells. So they are finding that, you know, it's not as, you know, as Jenny referenced before with Bethel Vandercook's book, The Body Keeps the Score. I mean, there's so many levels that trauma is lived in the body, not just experientially, but on a biophysiological level. And so, yes, and as Dr. Schwartz just pointed out so eloquently, that, you know, not the siblings don't always have the exact same DNA. And so then that can translate in how they interpret things even. Mm-hmm. And so what one of the siblings might interpret that, okay, that now I need to make sure I take care of my younger siblings. So as in Jenny's example, another sibling might be, well, these people are terrible and I can't stand them and I need to get away. You know, it depends on how they're interpreting what's going on and how it affects them and their role in that situation that creates different levels of adaptations And then those can either become memory networks of their own and become helpful in the moment, but maybe problematic later on.
Yeah.
And so then that might be what needs to be worked on with the EMDR piece. Right. You know, in the case Jenny was saying, you know, just wanting to take care of everybody, I'm sure that served her very well. It gave her distraction during the trauma and that got her through it. But she might be finding that now what she's coming in for is that it's not helping her anymore. And she's depressed because her own needs aren't being met anymore.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. What about those who don't have the memory of a trauma? We hear this, like they've been to some really traumatic experience, but they have no recollection of it.
So the body
does, but maybe the mind doesn't. Is that what happens?
That can be for a multitude of reasons. And that's why it's very important to go to a trained EMDR therapist. A lot of that is due to dissociation, which is a natural response that if it's something that's too ugly for the brain to process, it blocks it out and says, nope, too much for me. I can't handle this. We're just going to focus on this one piece of the memory or not at all and completely block it out. And that can vary to degrees, which is why training is so important. And again, people hear the word dissociation and, you know, it sounds heavy, but we all dissociate, you know, we've all been in the car driving to a destination. We get there and we're like, how did I get here? Because our brains are somewhere else. It's just that to a larger extent in some cases, because again, the brain isn't able to metabolize what's going on in the moment. So it could be part of that. It could be due to age and stage. If you have pre-verbal trauma, then it's not going to be able to be recalled the same way you are after verbalization, in that you might associate more with body sensations. Or it may be some people don't have visual memories because that's not the way their brains work. They can remember sound, or they can remember tactile or feeling, but they can't picture things. So there's all different ways to work with that within the scope of EMDR.
Mm. So interesting. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, we are talking about the mental health therapy EMDR with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and Autumn Pryor, who's a certified EMDR therapist. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Delilah is giving us a call from Westport. Hi, Delilah.
It's Delia.
Oh, sorry. Hi. Delia?
That's okay. Well, I wanted to say I'm really enjoying the conversation, how trauma and depotentiation using EMDR is being discussed. I'm a Havening Techniques practitioner, and I'd like to raise up some of the theories and practices that Dr. Ronald Rudin has developed, which actually harness what EMDR does with creating delta waves to change brain chemistry. So he wrote a book called When the Past is Always Present, and it describes how trauma is encoded in the amygdala through 10 years of researching about how the brain is working with trauma. And this discussion about, you know, why some people are more resilient or less resilient has a lot to do with how vulnerable the amygdala is, that part of our brain that isn't thinking. It's actually capturing information for survival. And the wonderful thing about Dr. Rudin's techniques, which are the Havening techniques, that are very, very similar in what you're talking about with EMDR, is that it's really rapid. And the part that's called reprocessing is actually usually clearing. Like the stuff is gone. So we were talking about being well, they didn't use the word fear, but like being trapped on a bridge as being something that you might be fearful of, and there might be other reasons why. Well, there's sort of this unconditional threat that the amygdala gives us information about. There's like with heights, with being trapped, with being in open spaces, being vulnerable, right? The amygdala mm-hmm. just goes on high alert. It's about vigilance. And that vigilance isn't something that we can think ourselves out of. Mm. And so the harnessing the delta waves to clear that vigilance is really what EMDR is about, and also havening. And I just wanted to bring it out because I've been practicing this for 7 years. I had complex grief trauma and had been in 40 years of different kinds of therapy, and I found havening 7 years ago, and it's changed my life. And I think EMDR has changed many people's lives also.
Oh, yeah,
in similar ways.
Can you explain what havening consists of?
Say it again. I couldn't hear you.
Can you explain what havening consists of?
So activation of the emotional content, the same way it's just been described by the EMDR therapist. You look at the body, you look at the emotion, you look at the belief, so you activate that. And we actually use a scale, a subjective unit of distress, like a pain scale, 0 to 10. And the point of havening is to find an act, and when we're doing it with for the point of trauma, is to activate that traumatic memory so that there are these receptors in the amygdala called AMPA receptors, and they activate. And the person can report in the subjective unit of distress how activated they are. It's subjective unit, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to get it up pretty high to activate that amygdala response. And then we apply, in havening, it's actually through touch, we apply the production of delta waves, which you can do with the eye movement, but in havening, we do it with touch. And in EMDR, there's also the vibrating pads, so we also do touch on the hands. And we apply that while we are distracting the client into something completely cognitively far away from whatever that traumatic event has been. So we might do something like, you know, sing the alphabet song while we're actually creating the delta waves. And we do that in sort of a rinse and repeat. It can take almost probably less time than I'm actually explaining it. But then we go back and we say, so now where's the subjective unit of distress? And it almost invariably changes quickly.
Yeah. Interesting.
It can be very complex.
Yeah.
That sounds very much like something that is currently being called EMDR 2.0 in the EMDR community, which has been probably informed by this fellow, but is been really developed mostly in the Netherlands, where exactly what you said, you sort of go through the beginning protocol, which you just described beautifully, of EMDR. And then you have someone do a dance move or spell something backwards. You know, there's been lots and lots of different ways of playing with this technique, and it's been growing and changing. And there's another thing called dyadic. Help me out here, Autumn. Dyadic.
I hate when that happens.
I don't know where you're going with that.
This is for our next episode, our episode in October, when we forget things.
Yes, so tell me, who is a candidate for this kind of treatment? Does it work on everyone? And are we using this on children as well as adults?
Certainly children, yes. And most people are a candidate for it. I generally would say that if you are a current user of drugs or alcohol and are in my office and are high so that your brain is not at its full function, that it's not going to work as well. But people who work with addictions are often able to overcome that. I would say that If you have something that is not sort of your general anxiety, depression, like that, something like that, you want to go to someone who's also a specialist in that thing. So if you have OCD, if you have addiction, if you have an eating disorder, you don't want to just be doing EMDR. You want to also be having someone who's a specialist in that field. I don't know that it works on people who have, say, schizophrenia or some other real neurological impairment, but I have known people who have worked with EMDR and people who have like brain trauma of various sorts. So, Autumn, are you back?
Yes, I am.
Okay, you go ahead and
I'm agreeing with
speak
everything
to
you're
that.
saying. I agree everything you're saying, and I would also just add to that two thoughts. If you're also taking anything like benzodiazepines, any Ativan or Valium or any of that stuff, that it makes it less effective because you're wanting to have some kind of a charge. And if you have something that's kind of muting that, it won't make it as effective. So your provider might ask you to not take any of those kinds of medications before session, and allowing it to be out of your body so that the EMDR can be as effective as it needs to be. I also have used it working with children, and I absolutely love doing that. They are so imaginative, and you allow for information to be used and processed in such a way that it's so empowering to them. They have less memory networks to plow through, right? If you're an older an adult, so you've got many more memory networks that you've got to work through. But I've worked with quite a few kids and teenagers where their imagination is such an asset, and it really is beautiful to see how they heal and what they use to heal.
And it moves more quickly. Yeah. The
Yeah.
other thing I wanted to mention that the woman who was speaking about havening said about subjective units of distress and wanting to get those up. You have to, again, this is why you want to work with someone who's certified and has a great, a good amount of training, is that you want it to be within the window of tolerance. So you want to get it up as high as you can, staying within the window of tolerance. So, for example, if you do work with someone who is dissociating, you have to make sure they don't dissociate while you're working. But
Right.
lots of people will dissociate to some degree while they're reprocessing trauma. So it's sort of a little bit of a dance to keep them activated to as high as they can get, but still within that window.
Yeah. Mark, you wanted to chime in, I think.
No, I'm fascinated with the details here,
Yeah.
I think we do want to kind of, well, when I was practicing it, there was a sense that you shouldn't, if somebody is very emotional, like a borderline personality can be, they're not so much good candidates for EMDR. Maybe if the two therapists can accommodate on that.
Yeah, you just go a little slower. There's ways to chunk things up. And again, your approach might be a little different. You might work with more current memories rather than past memories because you're not wanting to inundate people with lots of information that can be overwhelming. So there's all kinds of ways to manage symptomology. And titrate it to your client. And I guess that's, as Jenny said earlier, it is so important, first to go to somebody who's certified, who's had the training. There's so many different things that can be done to make this manageable and quick and effective. But you have to go to somebody who's got training. When you get out of basic training, it be people who have basic training, it just isn't enough if you're going to work with more complex cases. So I highly advocate for certification.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, Autumn, I wanted to ask you, I'm just thinking when we're talking about, this emotional state, and I'm thinking of, and maybe it's kids, adults on the spectrum, if this is different for them. I just think I have several people in my family who are on the spectrum, and I think when they have something emotional, they're just so matter of fact and analytical. I wonder, what are they really feeling inside? And is it the same? How do you deal with people who are on the spectrum?
So in that particular case that you're bringing up, there's lots of people who also, that's a dissociative feature where they stay in their brains, in their heads, because it's safer. And so with someone on the spectrum who is experiencing that kind of emotional stance, then we, while they're reprocessing, we just remind them to notice what they're feeling, to notice what's happening in their bodies, and to help them. That's part of our job in that particular situation, to help them reconnect with their emotions and help them reconnect with what's going on in their bodies, because they've done such a good job staying out of their feelings and staying out of their bodies.
Yeah.
And I just want you to know, Mindy, that my niece, just you, Mindy, my niece who is on the spectrum has been doing EMDR therapy and finding it tremendously helpful.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. And I just wanted to, if we could talk for a second about, we only have a couple minutes left, but untreated trauma. I mean, I think I'll go back to some people go like, I don't even want to remember that. I forgot. I've moved on. And our bodies aren't forgetting it, right? So what's the impact of untreated trauma?
Well, for many people that come through our offices, you know, or that don't come through our offices, I would imagine, and I, you know, talking personally and professionally with people, you know, it still does create problems for them on the daily. And so I put it out there that there's two kinds of hard, right? The hard you're dealing with, where it comes out sideways when you're not prepared, because this is an automatic response and that your body and your brain react in certain ways because of this. And that's hard. Or getting it treated and going through the work. That's hard. Pick your hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good point. I will say also, it's interesting that we've had several experiences with people who are receiving TMS in our offices and getting EMDR at the same time. And a couple of people have stopped, they've interrupted the EMDR treatment while they're getting TMS because they found that it was really difficult for them to, I think what they've reported, again, this is just a couple of people have reported that once they started doing TMS, the EMDR was somehow maybe more activating, more became overwhelming. So now when people ask us, people who are coming to, are going to start having TMS and they're getting EMDR, what do we recommend? I'll say, well, that's really, you know, between you and your EMDR therapist, but you might want to hold off on the EMDR while you're getting TMS. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's just, I don't really understand it, you know, why that might be an issue, but it does seem to have become problematic for some people.
And I guess it goes back to Autumn and Jenny, what you're saying is having somebody who's well-trained in this that can recognize when these things are happening and, you know, recommend the right course, right? So
I trade it better. Yep, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too, Mindy.
All right. Autumn Fryer, certified EMDR therapist, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, and social worker Jenny Putnam. Very fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.